What are learning disabilities? A very most important question, and perhaps a very tardy response on our part, so I apologize, but this may be our most important episode ever. What are learning disabilities? Define it. I'll give you some history and my own personal recommendations. I'm Sharon Sorrells, and this is The Great Shalom, Overcoming Learning Problems.
Celebrate the victory. Rejoice in what the Lord has done. Celebrate the victory. The enemy's on the
Okay, let's define learning disabilities. Huh, that's a big order. Look, we all know that all of us have strengths and weaknesses. We also know that none of us, this side of the fall, are omnicompetent. So what is a learning disability? Well, in Texas, and I think this is pretty typical, it's defined as a 16-point spread between IQ and standardized tests of academic performance. A 16-point spread between IQ and standardized test of academic performance. So IQ tests, what do you think they're based on? Well, the WISCAR, the Stanford-Binet are based on vocabulary, which in itself is academic performance. So to get this 16-point spread, you have to be statistically significantly brighter than average. And of course, academic performance can be affected by a lot of things. But here is the newsflash. Anyone who is able to obtain this diagnosis as learning disabled, I'm doing air quotes, quote, learning disabled, unquote, is by definition significantly brighter than average. So learning disability is very far from mentally retarded. In the 1990s, when I was working on my master's in sociology and I wanted to do some research on this, the only peer-reviewed article in sociology about learning disabilities proved that teachers thought that LD meant MR, meant mentally retarded. And just now, I just looked up the federal government's definition of, you know, I was looking up the statutes, actually, the IDEA Act, which I'll talk about in a minute. And the first picture where your eye first goes is of a Down syndrome child. Not really helpful. So a Down syndrome child could not get this definition. By definition, a Down syndrome child could not be learning disabled, although they might be covered under the same law in terms of discrimination, but it adds to the confusion. And of course, we don't say MR anymore. We now say developmentally delayed, which is a different thing too. So in this whole field, we've got lots of definitional problems, but I'm here focusing on what does learning disabled mean? It means that there is some sort of weakness in terms of performing in school that's not predicted by IQ. You've got an intelligent kid who's got problems in school for some sort of academic reason. And so that puts the whole question mark on the disabled thing. So to get the diagnosis, to get the label, to get some accommodation legally to say that you're a discriminated class, there had to be a claim of disability. Now, some people may be disabled, but other people just simply have a weakness that may or may not be able to be remediated. Okay, so if you have a condition that can be cured, I wouldn't call you disabled, because disabled sounds like it's a final condition. And I of course know all about learning labeling theory, and so we need to talk about that, about labeling theory, more fulsomely. But I will say that we all know that people live up to their labels, and certainly people are treated according to their labels, and a social environment that telegraphs expectations makes results in behaviors. So the whole label of learning disabled is extraordinarily problematic. But this is what we have in terms of the law and in terms of public school. But that is one of the reasons why at the beginning of this broadcast, I would never say learning disabled. That, and of course, I started out with a word of faith audience that is very much focused on positive confession. So vis-a-vis labeling theory, that makes sense. But somebody needed to know what I was talking about. Okay, so I'm here to help students who have problems in school, problems with learning. Okay, learning disabilities is what we call it. Now, I've defined it according to the Texas definition, and there have been updates, but let me go through the law for now. So, according to the law, okay, so the states, every state in the United States, is covered by the IDEA Act, I-D-E-A, IDEA Act. Now, I remember this as being PS 92-142, but when I looked it up just now, I'm getting referred to 20 USC Chapter 33. Anyway, I will give you the links in the show notes and on the blog at greatshalom.org, the links to first a fact sheet and then to the actual statute itself. So this is a federal statute and specifically and explicitly abrogates the state's rights. So it informs, it instructs, requires public schools in every state to not discriminate. And so this was the functional law that we worked under when my daughter was young. Now, there have been some updates, and I'll go through the history. But today, more children are claiming the 504. So it's easier to get services under 504, and it's less of a label, but it's still basically an anti-discrimination law, that children who have certain disabilities may not be discriminated against in their school. So the import, the agreed import of the law is that every child should be given a free and appropriate education, a free and appropriate education in the public school. What appropriate is might be argued. So let me give you a little bit of history. But again, I've put the links up for the law, and also I'm going to put a link up to an attorney's site and also to the HSLDA, the Homeschool Legal Defense Association. They may also have some information about rights law. We'll give you the statutes and also mentions the update. So there was an update in 2016. But let me give you a very brief overview of the history. Starting in, my timeline is going to start about 1960. At that point, not every public school had any program at all for any child who was not quote unquote normal. you understand that's only a statistical average, what is normal. But parents in the 60s worked hard to get a public education for children who weren't quote unquote normal. And the first group of children who were able to get this was the Down syndrome children. And so when I went to school, I was in the elementary school in the 60s, then there was a separate classroom for the children whose abilities wouldn't let them follow the academics at the same rate. And they had a curriculum that was more practical. They might be learning how to wash their clothes, and, you know, the rest of us were reading in a reader. And at least by the sixth grade, I was privileged to be in a school that had a major works literature class. So I was reading Hawthorne's mythology, you know, which most sixth graders were not reading. So there was some diversity of level of education. But you see, there's a pretty big gap there, I think, between washing your clothes and the regular education level. So parents continued to use their political franchise to try to get more services. And so about in the 70s, there were more special education classes, and there were some in the 60s, but mostly these came up in the 70s. And so parents felt that they had done a good job by getting self-contained classrooms with special instruction that was academic and was aimed at bringing those students up to average level. Or maybe, now remember, we're talking about bright kids. So there were also resource rooms, so the child might be pulled out of the regular class to do something, some remedial education. But there was still a social stigma for that child in doing that. By the 80s, there was a push for inclusion. So some parents, like a parent who may have a child in a wheelchair, might say, well, my child who goes in a wheelchair, she can do average sixth grade work. She's sixth grade age, so why isn't she in the sixth grade class? She doesn't need to be in a segregated classroom. And then on the side of the school, there was a push for inclusion because they didn't want to offer special services. They didn't want to offer self-contained classrooms because that was more expensive. And so inclusion was the banner issue. And parents said, well, okay. But there, of course, is a problem if your child is already having problems in school and then you take them out of the classroom. That becomes very difficult to do anything. They're how does that catch them up? They're not even there for the instruction. And by the 80s, it was very clear that there was an accommodation and there was not remediation. And there's a big difference. And when you're a parent and you're going through all of this hoorah, it's sometimes it escapes your notice that there's a difference. So, for instance, say we're fourth grade, Texas history, and your child is quote-unquote learning disabled because maybe they have dyslexia, so they're not reading at a good rate. And so accommodation would be she only has 5 questions on her exam rather than 15. But you see, that doesn't catch her up, and at the end of fourth grade, she's not going to know the same amount of Texas history. And in fact, her grade may or may not be improved if the, you know, she doesn't know which 5 questions. She's studying the same 25 possible questions. And by the way, this whole discussion of accommodation, did we get any remediation? So have we sent her to something like Orton-Gillingham language retraining so that she's taught how to read and spell in an organized fashion and in a multi-sensory fashion, which we all know should be happening to all of our children, but is not in any place that I know in public school. So Orton Gillingham Language Retraining has been a dyslexic program, a program for dyslexic students since the 20s. That was certainly available in the 80s, but that was not being offered in school. So there was no attempt to remediate. And there was some attempt to accommodate, but that never would catch a student up. So here you have a bright student who knows they're having problems in some area, and because of what the school is doing, they're getting further and further behind. Don't you understand? That's frustrating. Doubly frustrating. Trebly frustrating, because if the teachers think that this child is MR and give social cues like that, and then the rest of the school bullies this child, which that's the typical arc. So by the 2000s, then those families who were kind of cued into this, well, let me not skip ahead. So by the 90s, the ADA, the group that was used to going to bat legally for the disabled, the physically disabled, had been helping the learning disabled, but eventually they dumped them because it was just too many. And it took them away from their original goal of helping the physically disabled. By the 2000s, the parents who had, or the families who had made it through the public school system, were highly combative. And there was an entitlement going on in a culture, in the public school culture anyway. And so students were coming out, and they just knew how to fight, because that was the only way we were going to get anything in any public school. And so they would hit college. And so the same kind of the same kind of culture hit the college situation. I know in Texas, well, I won't call the name of the school, but anyway, there was one of the senior universities who had to fire a tenured professor because he had refused to follow the learning disabled laws, the IDEA Act in this case, and so he was fired. Well, that sent the fear of God and the government through the senior university system, of course, the community college system too. And so there were offices in every college set up to serve the student who was dually identified, dually labeled, had all the testing and had their paperwork. But often they were so combative that they majored on the fight, and they still weren't getting remediated. And so this caused a real problem in the senior university, because they have a culture of performance. In the community college, somewhat less so. But then it becomes a bureaucratic protocol nightmare. But again, I don't know if the students were ever helped, because there was no intention of remediation. Now, maybe in the tutoring centers, you know. So you had individual tutors and professors and instructors and so forth who could help. But by this time, the special ed teachers were swamped with a wide variety of disabilities. You had a lot of ED, community college and universities, you had PTSD because you had returning veterans, and of course you still had physically disabled people. So the learning disabled just got short shrift, in my opinion, and it was very, very difficult to help anybody, because by this time those students were focused on the combativeness of the bureaucrat. And I cannot blame them. I cannot blame them. So in all the school systems that I have personally dealt with, I have never once seen one follow the law in good faith. I have never seen a school system follow the law in good faith. Okay, So for now, least restrictive environment is least restrictive environment is the agreed upon standard. So we're going to help students in the primary classroom, in the public school. However, that often means that a teacher now has 25 instead of 35 students, but she has 25 students, maybe 20 of them have IEPs. Maybe one of them has behavioral disorders or more. Maybe she's got some ED students, meaning emotional disturbance. And so a normal teacher in a normal classroom is hard-pressed to give every student all of the attention that they may need. We have so many students who have so many problems. Thus, this broadcast. So least restrictive environment. That's the tug of war. That is where we are. And it's the tug of war between parents who want better services, which have never been really forthcoming in my view, and the administrators who want to have less expenditure. And so we've had this history. Okay. So the laws that we're working under are the IDEA Act and 504. Okay, so let me give you some clue about how to navigate that. Okay, now this is just a quick and dirty overview and would certainly be worth a whole hour, but we're just not going to try to do that. But so a school is required to respond to a request for testing within 10 days. There's a whole lot of foot dragging around this. So if you really want to get your child tested for learning disabilities, write the letter and send it certified return receipt requested. Then they're supposed to test them. They're supposed to give them a full test. If you specify that, you know, lots of batteries, which means that there's going to be both the standard IQ test, some performance tests, maybe they can get that from someplace else. But there should be tests for, or at least some screening for dyslexia, for Erlen syndrome, for lots of things, possibly hyperactivity and so forth. If you went to someone who specializes in this, they would have a doctorate in education, and the testing would last more than a full day, and it will cost thousands of dollars. So this is one reason why the school is reluctant to do this. Okay, they're probably not going to use an EDD, and anyway, they're going to try to get out of testing, and I have certainly seen cooked tests. I've also seen school counselors, school diagnosticians. They usually have a master's degree, school diagnosticians. And I've seen IEPs and ARD minutes. IEP means the Individual Education Plan. ARD is the minutes of the group meeting of the educators and the parents to plan the IEP. I've seen these minutes in non-standard English. The diagnostician I talked to did not have access to a DSM, the Diagnostical and Statistical Manual. She did not own one. The school did not own one. So this tells you about my low view of the system and the competence thereof. And that was decades ago. So anyway, then after the testing, there's supposed to be an ARD, which is a meeting that has the teachers who know the student, the parents, probably the principal is going to come, the school diagnostician, and somebody else, if somebody else did the testing. And that they are supposed to come to an agreement on what the IEP is. And so that will be a document, Individualist Education Plan. I've seen ARDs done without the parents there. That's completely illegal. And then the IEP, I've seen that completely ignored. It's not supposed to be ignored. But in many schools, I think you are going to find that to get that IEP followed, you're going to have an attorney go around with your child. Anyway, but you might get some movement in that area. Unfortunately, you've got this whole system focused on this child's weakness. So say you have a child who is in high school and maybe they are advanced in math, and yet they're reading on a lower level. Yeah, good luck getting them into a major works math class, which is what they need, and good luck getting them into some remediation so that they can learn to read better, or into a study skills class. You know, they'll just put them into a remedial education track, you know, so they'll be giving them lower level work. Well, this is not going to help your child get to college, and you've got a brighter than average student. Okay, so anyway, you can see I have a very negative view, and this is not what a Word of Faith person would tell you, but I think this is reality, and I think you should know about it. But anyway, you might find a school where everything is great, but I don't think so. Okay, so let's leave it there for this episode. And next episode, I'll go into what your experience might be in public school or in homeschooling, and I'll give you some practical advice. And I hope this hasn't been too much of a downer. I hope that it will prove to be very helpful, because it validates your experience. And I will give you some things to do. But I want to tell you that I really strongly disagree with the label disability, because that translates as if it is permanent and your child can succeed and do well. Often these problems can be remediated. If not, we can strengthen the strengths, and they can find their calling in their skill mix. And so I want to leave you with faith for success for your child and practical ideas. So you know a little bit about the lay of the land in terms of what learning disabilities are and what the situation is and has been in public school. And of course, we could be much more deep, and I'm sure there are details that have been updated, but this gives you a basic idea. And you know the land, you're ahead of the game. Okay, so this is Sharon Sorrell saying that God wants total well-being for all children.
Thank you for joining us for the Great Shalom broadcast with your host, Sharon Sorrells. Sharon is an author, educator, minister, parent, and grandparent committed to sharing the understanding of God's love and desire that all children experience optimal well-being in this generation and the generations to come.
I do want to say that I'd be delighted to hear from you. I would welcome ideas and questions on the website, greatshalom.org. You can simply type in the box underneath the posts if you're having difficulty. If for some reason the site is broken and there is a difficulty, let me know. But I think everybody knows how to do that these days. If you want to email me with a prayer request, you are invited to do so at info@greatshalom.org. If you want counseling, coaching, or some kind of professional time for me, then go to orgstrat.net, orgstrat for organizational strategies.net, and see my offerings there, and you're welcome to email me. Okay, so greatshalom.org, and do notice that there are products to be bought there, a whole package of homeschooling, and which is on a phenomenal sale. You'll never get it for less than that, but I know lots of people have embarked on homeschooling, and there's also a Dangerous Times product, which also is on a good sale. So go to greatshalom.org or Overcoming Learning Problems, and you will go to the tab for shop. Okay? Great to see you. Please share, like, and share, and let people know about this, because there are a lot of people going through a lot of pain who need this. Yes, thank you very much.